Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility presents the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, exploring ideas with innovators, change makers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by the Alchemist Brewery of Waterbury and Stowe, proud B Corp, using the power of business to support a clean environment and economic opportunity for all. Vermont Student Assistance Corporation. VSAC helps students of all ages save, plan, and pay for college and career training with education and career planning services, need-based grants, scholarships, low-cost education loans, and Vermont's official 529 college savings plan. Green Mountain Power, delivering clean, cost-effective, and highly reliable power to customers and offering cutting-edge products and services to reduce costs and carbon. UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. Norwich Solar Technologies, providing complete clean energy services to Vermont's schools, towns, nonprofits, and businesses. Concept 2, designers and manufacturers of Concept 2 rowing oars, indoor rower, ski erg, and bike erg, and proud to support nonprofit groups such as the Green Mountain Club, as well as nearly 700 VBSR members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit. Learn more at www.vbsr.org. Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. Today, we'll be talking about everything from sustainable business to climate strike. In the second half of our show, we'll be joined by some leaders of Vermont businesses who will be participating in a global climate strike this Friday, as well as the activities next week during what has been dubbed Climate Week. But first, in our first half hour, we're joined by Bram Kleppner. He is the CEO at Danforth Pewter, where he's been since 2011. He's led the company from declining sales and losses to double-digit growth, and he's overseen Danforth's becoming the world's first 100% solar-powered pewter workshop. He's also implemented company-wide profit sharing, paid parental leave, paid time off for community service. And Danforth is currently driving to zero fossil fuel use and raising its lowest wage to $15 an hour before Vermont does. He is the winner of this year's Terry Eric Award for Lifetime Achievement from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, an award that he will receive next week. Bram Kleppner, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So talk a little bit about how you got your start in business. I know that prior to Danforth Pewter, you were at Ben & Jerry's, and you co-led Ben & Jerry's first anti-global warming campaign. But what was your route into business generally? Because it sounds like you have a lot of interests, not just the bottom line.
Yes. You know, Ben & Jerry's in recent years has started describing themselves as a social justice company that happens to make ice cream. And, you know, I think I sort of arrived there a couple decades before they did in terms of that philosophy. I was really interested in how we address some of the biggest problems we face. And it felt as though at that time when I joined Ben & Jerry's, it was 1993, that Ben & Jerry's was really creating a new model of how a business can use its economic muscle to improve the world, to improve social justice, to improve the environment, rather than degrading it. And that was really exciting to me.
Were you always, were you a business major in college? Did you go the conventional route into business?
No, I was not a business major. I studied political philosophy, and through a variety of interesting circumstances, found myself living in Siberia for a couple of years after I graduated from college. And, you know, was there in 1991 and 1992 during a period of rapid transition. The Soviet Union fell apart while I was there, and they were just beginning to try to figure out what their society was going to be like and how they were going to organize things. And I had fallen in love with Ben & Jerry's, both the products and the philosophy, some years before. And when I returned to Vermont after having lived in Siberia, Ben & Jerry's was just opening a joint venture in Russia. And I called them up and said, "Hey, I love your ice cream. I speak Russian. Give me a job." And, with a few detours, that ended up working.
What is Siberia like? Aside from being the punchline of, you know, jokes that end with being sent to Siberia, sounds like you volunteered to go.
Yes, the rare self-exile to Siberia. You know, Siberia, sort of as a professional marketer, I would say Siberia has a great brand awareness. Everyone in the world's aware of it, but it has very low brand understanding because people just picture, you know, frozen tundra and prison camps. And Siberia is, in fact, you know, depending on how you measure it, is the biggest place in the world. And it encompasses a great deal. It's sort of the only place in the world where both tigers and polar bears live. You know, it stretches from the Arctic all the way down to subtropical along the border with China in the Far East, and has the biggest forest in the world and many of the world's biggest rivers flowing north to the Arctic, and is a remarkably large, varied, and empty place. And the town I lived in was actually pretty big. It was 500,000 people, which, you know, very large by Vermont standards, but relatively small by Russian standards. 400-year-old town that had an old university in it and a number of other academic institutions and lots of gorgeous architecture and lots of really friendly people.
What were you doing there?
You know, I mostly went in search of adventure in my youth, which I found in great quantities. But I taught English and I led tour groups of Westerners, and I did some translating, and I did some business consulting for local enterprises who are trying to figure out how sort of the free market worked and how independent business enterprises worked and things like that.
Was the collapse of the Soviet Union something that was greeted with joy there, or was it extremely disruptive?
You know, it.
And that was like 1989 to
1991. 1991 is in August was the coup attempt that led to the dissolution of the Soviet Union. You know, Siberia is a very long way from Moscow, and it really didn't affect things at all. You know, it meant that some of the other Soviet republics were no longer part of the same country as the Russian Republic was. But, you know, it wasn't sort of a revolutionary event with people out on the streets either protesting or dancing. Life just kind of went on. And, you know, Russians have endured a great deal in the last 1,000 years and are pretty stoic about just keeping on.
All right. Well, let's venture forth from Siberia to Vermont, and you can tell us the connection, if any. But you went from Ben and Jerry's, which went through, and you experienced it moving from its founders, Ben and Jerry, having to sell the company to Unilever, a large multinational company, and which was not a particularly happy transition for them when it occurred, to a family-owned company, Danforth Pewter, which also needed to move from a period of being run by a founding family to eventually you. Talk about that transition from founders running a company to the challenge of letting somebody else run it.
That's a great question. And at Danforth, as Fred and Judy Danforth, the founders and owners, moved towards retirement, I was very conscious that there'd been a lot of unhappy founder transitions. You know, in addition to Ben and Jerry, you can look at, you know, Alan Newman at Gardner Supply, and then Alan Newman at Seventh Generation, and then Alan Newman at Magic Hat, and Jeffrey Hollander, and lots of others.
It almost seems the norm that it goes badly unless, yes. Unless you're lucky.
So, you know, Fred and Judy Danforth and I talked a lot about that, and we had the luxury of time. We were able to plan their transition into retirement a couple of years in advance. And so we, you know, I think looking back, we ended up managing it pretty well. You know, we had them, you know, what I said to them was, look, the day you guys retire, I do not want it to be traumatic for anyone in the company, and I don't want it to be traumatic for you guys. And I said, you know, we're going to ramp you slowly down from 5 days a week to 4 to 3 to 2 to 1. So when you go from 1 to 0, it won't be this huge shock that the company will have had time to get used to. Because, you know, we have employees who have been there 30 years and had never known anything other than Fred and Jude I running it. And there was at least one who said, you know, I don't work for this company. I work for Fred and Judai. And when they go, I'm gone. And Fred and Judai retired almost 5 years ago, and she is still there working away happily. So I think we manage that. And you know, I said to Fred and Judai, who are, you know, wonderful, delightful, helpful, generous, supportive people, I said, listen, you know, you guys have had this long, happy marriage. I don't want it to fall apart because you retire and all of a sudden you got to deal with each other being at home all day together. So we're going to give you time to get used to being home alone together as well to make sure that all works. And I think it all worked.
You're listening to the Vermont Conversation. We're spending this half hour with Bram Kleppner. He is the CEO of Danforth Pewter, and he is the winner of this year's Terry Eric Award for Lifetime Achievement. I suppose you could say the highest award given by Vermont businesses for social responsibility. If you want to join this conversation, you can call us at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Tell us a little bit about Danforth Pewter. We sort of skipped over that part. How big is it? Where is it? When did it start?
Fred and Judai Danforth started the company in 1975. They were a 20-something married couple, both artists, and they did what young artists in Vermont do. They rented an old farm and set up a workshop in what had been the milking parlor and hung out their shingle and started going to craft fairs on the weekends. And they are both really talented artists and artisans. And at craft fairs occasionally, someone would come by and say, listen, I own a gift shop. My customers would love this. Do you sell it wholesale? So gradually they started selling it wholesale and started going to trade shows where they sold to retailers who own gift shops and boutiques around the country. And the company grew, you know, with some ups and downs, but grew steadily. There was a period in the 90s, actually at a trade show in New York in the late 80s, someone from Disney wandered into their booth and said, wow, this stuff's really beautiful. How would you like to be the exclusive licensee for Winnie the Pooh? And that more than doubled the size of the company almost overnight. So there were sort of 10 really good years.
The power of Winnie the Pooh.
The power of Winnie the Pooh, indeed. And for a variety of reasons, that relationship wound down at the end of the 90s. And it took the company a while. To quote Deng Xiaoping, we crossed the river by feeling for the stones and felt our way forward into going from being almost exclusively a wholesale business to being now 75% direct-to-consumer with our own retail stores and a website and selling on Amazon and all those things. So today we have 9 retail stores, 5 in Vermont and 4 on the East Coast, Maine, New Hampshire, Maryland, and Virginia. And a big online business, and we sell at wholesale to something like 1,200 retailers around the country. We have a custom design business. You know, we make all the bottle stoppers for Whistle Pig Whiskey, for instance. So we do projects like that. And we have almost, all told, we have almost 100 employees at this point.
And the employees that you do have, you have really kind of positioned them at the forefront of a lot of kind of big hot button social issues. You offer them paid parental leave. You offer them paid time off for community service. Employees sit on the board of directors. The company, as noted earlier, is 100% solar powered. And you're trying to get to $15 an hour minimum wage before the state of Vermont does. Perhaps you're already there. I'm not sure. Why? Why do these things?
There are a few reasons. And, you know, there's a sort of an inextricable combination of human reasons and business reasons. You know, we believe that global warming poses a fundamental threat to everything we care about, and that there are now happily things that we can all do to solve the problem, you know, even absent any leadership or help from the U.S. federal government. There are ways that we can clean up our power sources. As you mentioned, we built a solar farm, and we don't have a great deal of money. We're a rural manufacturer, a small rural manufacturer. But the legislation's in place, the policies are in place from Congress and from the Vermont legislature and from Green Mountain Power. There's support for clean energy production. So we were able to build a solar farm on an employee's land without laying out a single dollar up front. And we're actually now producing more than twice as much electricity as we use. So Gardner Supply is taking up the other half. And there are plenty of other places we use fossil fuel that we will try to eliminate. So, you know, fundamentally, it's important for all of our, you know, happiness and our children's happiness and our grandchildren's happiness to have a stable climate. But it's also something that our employees care about. And, you know, the more we are able to do things that make our employees proud to work at Danforth, the more engaged everyone is, and the better off the company is and the better off it performs. And our customers care as well.
What would you say, you know, when the argument comes up around a $15 minimum wage or paid family leave, you hear businesses saying, you know, we're going to lose money, it's going to cost us profitability. What have you found? What's been your experience at Danforth Pewter?
When a business spends money, if everything else stays equal, it does have to come from somewhere. And, you know, it either gets... it either comes from the owners, you know, they either take less money out of the business, or it comes from the employees in terms of foregone wages or fewer hires, or you carve it out of your vendors if you have the muscle to do that, or it comes out of your consumers' pockets, your customers' pockets. You raise prices to make it up. So if you are in a zero-sum situation, yeah, it has to come from somewhere. And, you know, can it, is there any room anywhere, you know, is it important enough so it's worth taking from one of those places? But it's often not a zero-sum game. Often doing these things makes you money in other ways that aren't immediately obvious. You know, everyone knows hiring and training, employee turnover is expensive. And so, yes, you raise your wages, your weekly payroll goes up by that number of dollars, you have to hit payroll every other week all year long, but you save money because your employees have longer tenure. And it's not just the cost of hiring and training. There's a whole learning curve once someone starts. And, you know, we've been in business 45 years. I don't believe we've ever hired someone who had Pewter working experience. We have trained every single person in our workshop. So the more that we can make it possible for them to stay at Danforth a long time, the better off we are.
Again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to the Vermont Conversation, and we're talking with Bram Kleppner, the CEO of Danforth Pewter. You wear another hat that people generally don't know, and that is that you are the great-nephew of Amelia Earhart, the feminist heroine and pilot who was the first woman to fly across the Atlantic. She disappeared in 1937 while attempting to fly around the world. Your grandmother was Amelia Earhart's younger sister, and your mother is writing a book about her. So what happened to Amelia Earhart?
You know, I think there are a lot of theories, and there are a lot of hints and clues to support them all. There are people who believe she ended up on an island 300 miles south of where she was headed. There are people who believe she was captured by the Japanese and taken off to Saipan. There are people who believe she turned around and never got close to the island she was aiming for. And there are interesting little hints and suggestions that support all of these. But there's not a single shred of actual evidence for any of them. And, you know, I would say two things. One, I mean, you'll recall, it was just a couple of years ago, this huge 747 from Indonesia disappeared without a trace. with all of our GPS and all of our radar, this giant plane disappeared without a trace. And it took them like 8 months before they found a single thing. So you can imagine in 1937, without any of that technology and a much smaller plane, planes disappeared in those days without a trace. You know, Amelia's was not the first plane to disappear without a trace. It happened. The ocean is huge. The planes were small. And the locating technology wasn't very good. So, you know, I think most likely, and this is my mother's view as well, most likely is what is sort of the simplest, most obvious explanation. She ran out of gas. You know, it was a tiny little island she was aiming for. The navigation equipment wasn't great. You know, missed her target, ran out of gas, and disappeared into the Pacific Ocean.
Why is Amelia Earhart so important to us all these years later? And why is it important to your family? What happened to your great aunt?
So why Amelia Earhart is still an icon is a great and really interesting question. I think there are a few factors that went into it. One is the fact she disappeared. You know, if she were still alive, you know, there were lots of really famous people in the 20s and 30s about whom we know nothing at all these days, don't even know their names. And, you know, her fame in the 20s and early 30s may well have faded if she hadn't mysteriously disappeared. So that certainly helps to keep people interested and engaged. You know, another is that she was a very charismatic figure and, you know, sort of slightly gender ambiguous. You know, she was tall and lanky and wore men's clothes and had short hair. So there's a little bit of interest there as an unusual character from those days.
I mean, was she gay?
Unknown. Certainly plenty of speculation that she was. She was married once to a guy. And, you know, there's various speculation about you know, other relationships she had during that marriage. But, you know, she was also way ahead of her time. You know, she had a prenuptial agreement. It was a letter that she wrote to her husband saying, look, we can try getting married. You know, if after a couple of years either one of us is unhappy, we're going to go free. And she also said in that letter, you know, somewhat elliptically, but she said, listen, I am not going to consider myself bound monogamously to you, and I will not expect you to be bound monogamously to me. You know, she said something like, I won't hold you to an outdated medieval code of honor, nor will I expect to be held as something like that. But it was pretty clear what her intent was. And she also fought hard for women's careers and women's education, and women's education being important for reasons other than just preparing them to be good wives and homemakers, but preparing them to do important work in the world. And, you know, in 1930s, she was advocating that. So I think, you know, her feminist thinking and her charisma and her disappearance and her courage. Flying airplanes in those days was dangerous, and she knew it, and everyone else knew it, and pilots died all the time. And she kept getting in the cockpit and kept pushing farther and farther and higher and higher.
So if we do someday solve the mystery of what happened to Amelia Earhart, and I understand there's a National Geographic expedition currently looking in a Pacific island, what will you feel if they find her plane?
You know, I don't have very strong feelings. You know, I tend to defer to my mother, whose belief it is that it's a huge waste of money to try to find it, and people have spent millions of dollars. And my mother looks around and says, gosh, we've got poverty and inequality and violence and war and hunger and all of these things. Let's put the money towards solving, like, our real problems and not trying to figure out where an 85-year-old plane wreck is. You know, I think it would be somewhat satisfying on one hand to know what the end of the story is, because we don't know. All we know is she took off from Papua New Guinea, and that's all we know. We don't know how it ended.
So you're about to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award, which I'm going to guess makes you think a little bit about your lifetime. What do you hope when you're done doing this whole business thing, part of your life, what do you hope that the difference that you've made will be?
You know, I would hope to leave our Vermont community just a little bit fairer and a little bit healthier and a little bit more prosperous than it would have otherwise been.
Well, that would certainly be an epitaph that anybody would want. You also serve as chairman of the board of the Population Media Center, which promotes the rights of women and girls in the developing world. Why is that an interest of yours?
You know, for a very long time, I have felt that the two great threats to our long-term security and prosperity are global warming and human population growth. And they are intertwined, but they are independent problems. And Population Media Center is doing magnificent work on helping people have the size families they want.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Bram Kleppner, I want to thank you for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Bram Kleppner is the CEO at Danforth Pewter, and next week he will receive the Terry Eric Award for Lifetime Achievement from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility.